You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, August 6th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, the 69th anniversary of our dropping an atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Greg Mitchell will be with us to remind us of the horrors we unleashed and suppressed. Also on the program today, new report. Not exactly a surprise, but you will not believe, out of a billion votes cast over a 12-year period, how many cases of voter fraud have been reported, never mind prosecuted. Also, the Big Grift, a charity ostensibly to help our military personnel, is just a slush fund for a Tea Party PAC. Meanwhile, senators on the Senate Intelligence Committee taking a little bit of an issue with the redacting practices of the CIA when it comes to the Senate Intelligence Torture Report. And there's a third leaker, or I should say a new leaker, of NSA materials. Also, major password hack. Millions of passwords, perhaps, have been stolen.
Billions.
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 With a B. Time to change your passwords, folks. And surprise, surprise, apparently, new research shows that cutting off unemployment benefits of long-term unemployed does not convince them to go back to work. I know that's a huge shock, ladies and gentlemen. Let's start, though, with some good news. And let me just say also, sorry about yesterday. I had a funeral to attend. Close family friend. Very sad, but I appreciate your indulgence. good news, or actually, I don't know, good news, but it's a story with a positive twist, if you will. There is an interim president of Kentucky State University, a guy named Raymond Burst. He is going to be the president for a year as they seek to fill that position permanently. And he has given up more than $90,000 of his salary so that university workers earning minimum wage could have their earnings increased to $10.25 an hour. Burst said, "My whole thing is I don't need to work. This is not a hobby. But in terms of the people who do the hard work and the heavy lifting, they are at a lower pay scale." His annual salary had been set at nearly $350,000. He had been KSU's president from 82 to 89, then was an executive with General Electric for 17 years. He retired in 2012 with good benefits, he said. The raise in pay for these employees will actually stay in place after he leaves, and it will be the rate for all new hires as well. His new salary is now at about $260,000. So good for him. But frankly, you know, we shouldn't have to wait for the largesse of one individual to give people a living wage in this country. Minimum wage, of course, has not kept up with inflation, nor has it kept up with workers' productivity. If it kept up with the former, we'd be somewhere about $15 to $20, and productivity would push us up closer to about $22, $23. So I don't anticipate anything from Congress anytime soon, of course, and it's not just because they're on break. But it's time to pay people a living wage in this country, despite the fact that some of us, our libertarian friends, would have us believe that would mean they'll all lose their jobs to, I guess, nothing, to robots. And then the people at the robot factory hopefully will get a living wage as well.
Better than nothing.
Better than nothing, as they would say.
Hey, all right, hey.
We're going to take a break. We'll be right back with Greg Mitchell. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Greg Mitchell. He is the author, or I should say the latest, is author of his latest, The Atomic Cover-Up. And, of course, he writes daily at Pressing Issues, which you can find at gregmitchellwriter.blogspot.com. Greg, thanks so much for taking the time today.
Hi, Sam. Always happy to be here.
So it is the 69th anniversary of the day that we dropped the first of two atomic bombs. That one was the first 69 years ago was on Hiroshima. I mean, this is something that you've been writing about for years. I mean, why is it so important for us to recall this event?
Yeah, I've been writing about it for over 30 years, and I went to Hiroshima and Nagasaki 30 years ago for several weeks, and I've written three books, et cetera, et cetera. So it's something I return to every August. I've probably posted another dozen stories in the past day. I've always thought it was incredibly important for several reasons, including the fact that it has influenced America's views towards a nuclear buildup on a nuclear arms race in decades past, and even today influences Americans' views towards the actual use of nuclear weapons, even though, of course, our leaders and media and people will say, oh, never again, and we must never use them. But in fact, we still, polls show, certainly media reports show that majority of people in the U.S. still support the use of the bombs. Then no U.S. president has ever criticized it except for Eisenhower when he was out of office. So there's a sense that, never again, but still defending those two two choices, and which is completely contradictory. And second, it's just it's sort of the moral choice of deliberately bombing civilians. We've seen it on a lesser scale, but still horrid scale, and in Gaza. Certainly, the Gaza example brings back every thought of Hiroshima, just in the sense of deliberately targeting areas where civilians will die. And in the case of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, indeed, we dropped the bombs over the center of cities. It was not a military. Truman, in his first words about the attack, said we've dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, a military base. Well, there was a military base in Hiroshima, but the bomb was deliberately dropped over the center of the city. And in fact, we were outraged by the number of dead children in Gaza in the past couple weeks. But in Hiroshima, on one day, we killed 20 to 30,000. And have found it acceptable since then, most people. So, a little perspective there.
20 to 30,000 children. How many people were killed in Hiroshima? And we should talk about the death tally from Hiroshima really rolled on for decades and decades.
Well, that's, of course, the radiation effect and other effects. So they officially today placed the toll at about 150,000. Some people feel they maybe add some people who may not have been related, but still the minimum might be 130,000. The reason so many of them were women and children, the vast majority, was because, most of the men were off at war or were working in a, factory miles away. Most of the people in the city were women and children, and so they had a disproportionate amount of casualties there. And the same in Nagasaki. Nagasaki didn't even have a major military base, so they were, very industrial. So, it brings into focus, as much as we want to put it behind us, and some people do put it behind us, the whole notion of deliberately targeting tens of thousands or more than 100,000 for extermination. And I know there's extenuating circumstances. I know World War II was horrible. I know there are questions on whether Japan was going to surrender very soon. I happen to be in the camp that believes that, and Truman seemed to be in this camp, if you go by his diary, that Japan would have surrendered within days because of the Soviet invasion. As he wrote in his diary, "Finny Japs," when that occurs, and indeed the Soviets, as scheduled, declared war and marched against the Japanese on August 8th. And so I'm in that camp that believes that the war would have ended very, very shortly without the bomb. I know there are others who disagree, but I think when you're talking about the death of so many, particularly civilians, I think the weight of evidence has to be on those who believe it was a good idea, especially since in this case it set a terrible example for, until today, really, about the usefulness of nuclear weapons, about the ways you can defend their use, the way you can justify it, building more of them, building better ones, targeting, first strike targeting, and that it sets an example. And it's certainly an example that has not been repudiated by the U.S. media or its leaders, in great contrast to the rest of the world, or most of the rest of the world.
Well, this may be remedial for some, but tell us what the rationale was. Obviously, Hiroshima and Nagasaki were not the line. It's very hard to draw the line directly from this will hinder their military capacity, right? So tell us. For those who may not know or recall, because as a child, I remember, maybe around the age of my daughter's age now, 9 years old, reading I can't remember what book it was, but it was like Fat Boy. It was the story of the bombers, and it was all from the perspective of these guys who dropped the bomb to end the war.
Right.
Now that was, you know, we were only 30 years out at that time. And now, you know, 69, 70 years later, it just seems like it's almost absent from the curriculum. But like you say, the implications continue on, but talk about that.
Well, I posted a video today, in fact, where John Stewart a couple of years ago dared to suggest that maybe it wasn't Truman's great decision, and he got so much criticism that he then apologized. You can imagine John Stewart the next night going on and apologizing for daring to question Truman. So, I mean, that has been the American narrative. And, I mean, the history in a nutshell. Yeah,
tell us what the narrative was at that time. I mean, what was the justification?
Okay, we built the bomb to attack Germany or Japan. Germany surrendered, and so Japan was still fighting. And we had been firebombing Japanese cities and defeating them across the Pacific. And now it was down to the last leg. We had all that was left was an invasion of Japan. But they had almost their entire navy was shot. Their air force was shot. They were starved out. They were on their last legs economically and food supplies and so forth. Nevertheless, the American narrative is that they would have kept fighting until this invasion, which was scheduled to start the first leg in November or December, and then the second leg, and I think it was February or March. So the invasion was quite a ways off. And where the narrative gets confusing is that people will say, ah, but, you know, my father was heading for the Pacific and would have been invading, or we would have lost tens of thousands of casualties in the invasion, as if the invasion was fated to happen. And in fact, there is no way that the invasion would have happened, because Truman knew, and again, you go to the Truman diary and his records, he knew that he had the option of using the bomb. He knew the Soviets were going to invade. The question was what might the surrender terms be? There was no way he was going to send those armies into an invasion when he had other options, which included what he eventually did, which was, even though he had said we would only accept unconditional surrender, and the Japanese were saying, well, we might surrender if you let us keep our emperor. After we used the bombs, suddenly the U.S. negotiating principle changed, and we made the surrender conditional, and we accepted the emperor, as you know. The fact that there's no question there was a giant invasion plan, they had to plan it. There's no doubt that if it had happened, we would have lost tens of thousands of, injured or killed. The Japanese would have lost more. No one disputes that. The question is how likely is it that would have ever happened, given the fact we did have the bomb and that the Russians were invading? And, so there are those of us who believe that Truman, at the minimum, should have held off using the bombs for a week or a month or whatever, that there was no absolute need to use them at that moment. And we'll never know if he had put it off for a week or a month, what might have happened. But I believe the weight of evidence has to be on, no matter what we did, Japan would have kept fighting, we would have had this invasion, and all that would have happened.
Why was Hiroshima chosen as the city to bomb first, as opposed to Nagasaki, but in general?
It was always number one on the target list. It had not been heavily bombed, and we wanted, this goes into the the dropping the bomb as a big experiment. We wanted to get a clean result, if you can call it that, a clean result. We wanted to be able to judge how this bomb worked, and if we dropped it on a city that had already been firebombed, of course it would have killed a lot less people, but it would have been hard to tell what it really did. So Hiroshima happened to be, unluckily, and I've been there and I've seen this, it's in a kind of a bowl. It's surrounded by hills except on one side, and it was the city of 350,000, and you could, and we did, drop it over the center of the city, so you had this also, what was called a focusing effect, blast would rocket out to the hills and then come back in and kill even more. So it was just an ideal target. It did have a military base, but it was, you know, not, you know, it was a relatively small part of the city. I think that it's estimated that maybe 10,000 soldiers were killed there in the bombing. And then Nagasaki was actually number three on the list. Also, it had not been heavily bombed. There was a city called Kakura, which was number two, but on the Nagasaki day, they found it was obscured by clouds, so they went on to Nagasaki. And in fact, Nagasaki, we used the plutonium bomb. Unlike the uranium bomb at Hiroshima, the plutonium bomb became our weapon of choice. And in fact, if it had landed on target, would have killed as many or more than in Hiroshima. Fortunately, it landed somewhat off target, so only maybe 75,000 or 80,000 died. So that was basically the targeting.
Was there an awareness of what the destruction would be, not just in terms, obviously, in terms of the physical destruction, but, I mean, did I imagine that the Defense Department, that Truman, had a document that said, we project X, Y, or Z to happen. I mean, what do we know about what they projected?
Well, we'd had the Trinity test just 3 weeks earlier, and so we saw and filmed and knew exactly the incredible explosive force, also the radiation effect, although we covered it up. You know, you mentioned my book, Atomic Cover-Up, and that book, along with an earlier book I did with Robert J. Lifton, really focuses on the cover-up. It focuses on what we knew and when we knew it, and then how for decades we tried to keep the truth from the American people, or most of the truth, and that involved the radiation effects. It involves, you know, the true effects on civilians. You know, atomic cover-up focuses more on the suppression of film footage that was shot by the U.S. military.
Yeah, I want to talk about that in a moment. I'm just curious as to, like, when they're calculating what was going to be done. I mean, because this yep. you know, again, it's, you know, to talk about the really indiscriminate killing of 20,000 to 30,000 children and tens of thousands of women. I mean, it just non-combatants. You know, there's a calculation that goes in here, right? I mean, you know, the thing that we're told that separates party from another in terms of whether or not they're terrorists is the idea of, like, well, our intent is to hit military targets, to kill civilians. But when you go into an enterprise, you know, just on the basic sort of like legal theory, when you go into an enterprise knowing that X is going to happen, you have liability for that. And I'm curious as to what our assessment was. I mean, was there a document that says we will probably end up killing 30,000 children? Or,
yeah.
You know, I mean,
well, I don't know. I don't think they didn't really want to focus on the children. They certainly had documents and assessed the fact that this would likely wipe out the city. And knowing this is a city of 350,000, you know, you do the math. I guess the point is that the effect of the bomb was not a surprise to anyone. After the Trinity test, particularly, the atomic scientists really got behind a petition to ask Truman to do a demonstration shot, you know, off the edge of a city or someplace where the Japanese could see it, do something to hold off using the bomb. You know, most of the atomic scientists had gotten into the project partly because they were, you know, wanted to get at Hitler. They wanted to get at Germany. Germany surrendered. They saw that Japan was on the close to surrendering, and so they lost a little bit of heart for using it, and felt there were alternatives, such as a demonstration shot or just holding off. Of course, that didn't happen. And that's because they were very, particularly after the Trinity test, they were very well aware. And then after the Hiroshima bombing, some scientists celebrated. Others, you know, there's, you know, accounts of scientists throwing up. Scientists, you know, Oppenheimer, of course, was haunted the rest of his life. And then you had people like Eisenhower, General Eisenhower, who had told Truman's top aides that he was against the use of the bomb. He was disgusted by the use of it. He thought it was unnecessary. So there was revulsion in some quarters, but the American press and the White House and so forth managed the story so that people didn't get the full information, and the impact on what we had done was not fully known for many, many years.
Your book is The Atomic Cover-Up, and we're, of course, linked to it on majority.fm. But how concerted was it? I mean, was it a matter of just we're going to suppress a couple of films? Or, I mean, how was there an apparatus that was designed to basically come in, and we occupied Japan for half a dozen years, I guess, maybe?
Not quite that long, but three
close.
Years,
was there an agency? Was there a task force that was specifically like,
right,
your job is to make sure that the implications of this are muted?
Yeah, absolutely. The U.S. military, via MacArthur's office in Tokyo, seized all Japanese photographs that their photographers were taking, and all newsreel footage that they took, seized that. And there were Japanese really didn't see photos that their people had taken or anything for years. That was a tight suppression. And the U.S., when we sent reporters and photographers there, was subject to strict censorship from Tokyo. It's the famous story about Wilfred Burchett, the first reporter who got there, who had to circumvent the censorship by sending something practically in code via London, where it got published. The first reporter into Nagasaki, named George Weller, a very well-known war correspondent, filed dispatches from Nagasaki. They were killed by MacArthur and weren't found for 50 years. And then, as I mentioned, the U.S. military sent this elite film crew to shoot at massive length effects in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And that footage was suppressed for decades and only slowly came out, partly because of things I covered over 30 years ago. And so it was quite complete. Now, yes, people saw glimpses of it. There were photos published of destroyed landscape. People certainly got some sense of the destruction in the city, buildings and structures, other structures and so forth. But the full effect on people, radiation hazards were covered up. Were managed. It slowly came out about this new thing called radiation disease or A-bomb disease. But the true extent of it and the true radiation hazards, and again, looking to what was the effect of this or why does this all matter? Well, for decades, partly because of the suppression, we had all of those hundreds of nuclear tests, U.S. nuclear tests in the Pacific and in Nevada, where soldiers were subjected and local people were subjected to radiation clouds. When I was growing up in the 50s, I was subjected, radiation drifted over the U.S. Everyone, 2,000 miles away, like me, was getting a dose of radiation in milk and in other things. And of course, the nuclear power industry developed quickly because this radiation fear was minimized. There's all kinds of after effects of this 1945 use of the bombs and the acceptance of the use of the bombs.
What in Japan? How did that track in Japan? I mean, I just when you read and you see the images, and I watched the video that was posted on your site this morning, and it's just it's horrific, and it's I think it's one of several that you're going to be posting, I think, over the course of the next couple of days, but. It just occurs to me, how is it that you get something like Fukushima, in a country that had been subjected to this horror on one level? How has Japan come to reckon with it?
Right. Well, I've been quite a student of this. The Japanese, as we saw with the occupation, once we made this conditional surrender that they kept their emperor, MacArthur, came in, and they, you know, they're often praised for sort of accepting the inevitable. They, you know, they lost, then let's move on. And there's a lot of that in their reaction to the atomic bombings. Now, on the one hand, it must be emphasized, they then drafted a new constitution which basically banned that they would ever develop nuclear weapons themselves or even allow them on their land. And, you know, the U.S. famously has got around that over years. But, you know, right in their constitution, they say, we're pacifist and we'll never have nuclear weapons on our soil. So that's one part of their reaction. The other part was sort of, a guilty feeling that, okay, we did, you know, we started the war, we did bad things. We don't want to have that brought up continually. And we know they, for years, they censored some of their own textbooks and things like that. This is all true. But part of that also went into, they didn't really want to talk about Hiroshima and Nagasaki that much because, you know, it brought up a bad, you know, a bad image of them from World War II. So even some of the survivors have complained for decades that they were not treated all that well by the Japanese government because they were kind of pariahs and they sort of wanted them to go away, you know, shut up and accept it. And that's how much of the country has been. Let's not dwell because it's, you know, after all, we helped provoke it. So it's been a very mixed reaction. But, you know, of course, the end result is they have not developed nuclear weapons. And in terms of Fukushima, you know, they would say, we are this tiny, landlocked country. We had to develop nuclear weapons. We just don't have the resources to do other things. So we have to have nuclear power. We have this Hiroshima stigma, but, you know, we really didn't have much choice. So, you know, I think that's the way that plays out.
I mean, was there an era, and like you say, you've been writing on this for 30 years now, but was there a particular time where there felt like the United States was ever sort of addressing this or reconciling this? Like, I don't remember as a kid ever there being anything other than, you know, Fat Boy and Glory. I can't remember the name of the book.
Little Boy and Fat Man.
Yeah, exactly. And it was written for young kids to read.
There certainly was no reckoning or attempt at reckoning until the 50th anniversary in 1995, and I was very involved in that and saw how the media played out, and I've written about it a great deal. And there were things like, you know, the U.S. media would cover, they talked to survivors, they would cover some of what happened there. And it's sort of like with Gaza, you know, they can point to a lot of stories that, you know, depicted what terrible things happened in Gaza and so forth. But with Hiroshima, they would then ultimately end up embracing the official narrative, which was we really didn't have any choice. And, you know, one of the prime examples of that was the one TV newsman who had, you know, who really put out a major report, I think it was a two-hour special, that questioned the official narrative, was Peter Jennings. And I think that documentary may even be available on YouTube. And then he took incredible heat for it, you know. He's Canadian, you know. He's, you know, liberal. He's pro-Japanese. He's, you know, he doesn't understand, you know. So the one newsman does one TV program, and he was, you know, vilified. The other example, just very quickly, was some people may remember the Smithsonian, the Air and Space Museum tried to mount an exhibit in 1995 of the Enola Gay, the plane that dropped the bomb. They had about half of it put back together, and they were surrounding the plane, which the plane itself kind of glorifies the bombing. But they had this full-fledged exhibit around it, which looked in a more balanced way on the dropping of the bomb, and was it necessary? And it was approved by numerous historians, and was, quite balanced. Well, even the fact that it raised any questions about maybe we didn't have to use the bomb, or maybe there was a downside, caused veterans and the media and right-wing congressmen to freak out, and the exhibit kept getting cut back, and in the end, it got killed. The exhibit itself, they showed the plane with no exhibit. So this is as recently as 1995, where the country really was, in many quarters trying to come to grips with this. And the, you know, the major national, attempt at that was completely shut down, and only the, you know, the pro-bomb narrative was allowed.
You write today that there's been at least a slight change in our recognition of this, in the sense that we're now sending ambassadors.
Right.
Just talk about that.
Well, not only has no president ever gone there while in office, but they never sent an envoy of any sort to the memorial services in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I think it was about 4 years ago now, Obama broke that tradition and started sending the U.S. ambassador to both memorial services. And now, as I write today, Carolyn Kennedy is the U.S. ambassador. So now we've had a Kennedy today in Hiroshima at the official ceremonies. And I presume she's going to go on to Nagasaki. So, but when that was announced 4 years ago, Obama took all, he's pro-Japanese, or he's pro-this, or he's against the bombing, and of course Obama rushed in and said, no, it has nothing to do with that. We just think it's time to, send an ambassador. But, again, this is an example of something that seems perfectly, rational, and even a small attempt to come to terms with this is attacked, in the media and in political circles.
Well, what really strikes me is how the ability to sort of shape that narrative has, in really just in the last, I think, 10, 15 years, the nature of the internet and of social media and things like YouTube. Because even now, like you say, as you post that footage that was taken in the aftermath of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, even now it's really only available to the public through YouTube. We've seen clips, I think you said, in documentaries, but that it is really impossible to control the narrative of something. To contemplate controlling the narrative of something so large and so devastating today seems impossible. And in fact, I think that's a part of the reason, if not the reason, why we are seeing the Israelis unable to control that narrative in Gaza.
Right. Well, I think first of all, what you're referring to this footage, people could just go to YouTube and put in atomic cover-up, and they'll come right to my video. It's just simply atomic cover-up search. But I think what you're saying is all true, but I think it's more for, current and ongoing events. I think a historical event, I think social media is, a little less influential there. Most people just throw up their hands and say, well, I don't know, it's too big, it's gone on for too long, and there's so many other things to look at. So I understand that. I think there may be a generational change that won't have a lot to do with social media. It's just older folks who, were alive then or have fathers who, have told the stories about, Hiroshima saved my life. And again, I don't discount those stories, but that has been the overwhelming narrative. And I think, younger people, even as we see with Gaza and Israel, is quite a age gap when you look at Gallup poll on what their view. So I think it's similar here. I think we probably see it with the death penalty, capital punishment. There's a lot of stubborn, you want to call it, biases or narratives that are going to be, changed over time, just generationally. I think people tend to get a little more conservative as they get older and so forth. So we'll see.
Well, it's different. It seems to me it's different from the death penalty in the sense that there was such an emotional investment that was direct, when you talk about this. And I would say the same thing, I think the situation in Israel is analogous in the sense that you had a generation that had an emotional investment, a deep, deep emotional investment in the creation of the State of Israel or in the ending of World War II, and they passed that emotional investment on to their children. But there's right. the resonance as it travels over generations begins to diminish. And then there's more opportunity for exploration. That to me seems to be the operative factor that it would have to take 70 years, 65 years right. until we could even send an envoy to Hiroshima.
Right.
Is amazing.
Right. Well, yeah, and I think that I think in favor of changing views on the Hiroshima is simply that nuclear threat is still with us. The U.S. still has a first strike policy. I don't know if everybody knows that, but we have never repudiated our right or our claim to use nuclear weapons first. We still have that. We still have thousands of warheads, and there's still plenty of hotspots in the world, and there's plenty of chance of accidental nuclear war. So there's a lot of reasons for people to go back and say, you know, we never really came to terms with the two times we've used them. We never really said, you know, when we say never again, we have to mean never again. And that doesn't mean making exceptions. And we've made exceptions for 69 years. And so I think it is. It's a current issue, but sometimes it's difficult to make people think that, you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki are really current issues.
Well, Greg Mitchell, I appreciate your coming on and talking to us about it. The book is Atomic Cover-Up. You can also go to YouTube and just simply search Atomic Cover-Up there to get to some of these videos, which are really just incredibly just shocking and disturbing. And I appreciate your giving us your perspective on it today.
Sure. Thanks, Sam. Anytime.
All right, folks. We will head into the funner half, as it were. Just a reminder, it is your contributions to this program that keep it alive. You can become a member at majority.fm. You will ensure our ability to do this show day in, day out, as well as, and as a thank you to you, we give you an extra 50 minutes of content. Tomorrow on the program, Rick Perlstein will be here to talk about his latest book, which is in a way basically the third in a trilogy of the development of the conservative movement. And there's all sorts of fake controversy around the book, in my estimation, that Rick Perlstein cited historical facts and paraphrased things. I'm not even quite sure what it is. We will touch on it briefly when we have him on. But I think in the end, hopefully it will sell more books for him. And it is, you know, I am still plowing my way through the book. I doubt I'll have all of it finished by tomorrow, but we'll have a great conversation with Rick Perlstein. And just looking forward, we will be going on vacation next week. I think Matt and Mike will be doing Monday, and we'll maybe do like a pre-record on for Wednesday. But we will then be back the following Wednesday. So we're going to have some new content for you, and we're going to have some best ofs over the course of those, 6 days. Just to looking ahead. And a reminder, if you can't afford a membership of this program but you want access to the better half, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. I am still digging through past emails, and we'll catch up in the coming days from my brief turn at doing pro bono work for major radio corporations. And you can also help support this program by simply going to majoritereportkickback.com, clicking on the Amazon link, bookmarking it. Anytime you buy stuff from Amazon, buy it through that link. We get a kickback. Every little bit helps. And, of course, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. I'm surprised that we don't have more people buying coffee from Just Coffee. It's great coffee. It is at, if you buy whole bean coffee, or I think they can grind it for you too. If you buy it at a store, it's certainly competitive, the prices, definitely with the discount. And it's great coffee, and it's all fair trade, and it's a co-op. You can get the Majority Report blend, which makes a great gift. You're going over to have dinner. You're going to bring a bottle of wine? Who cares, man? Everybody does that. Then it's awkward. Do you drink the bottle of wine, or do you let them keep it? Because then is the question is like, oh, we just brought this over because we wanted to drink it. And we figured we'll share it with you. But if you bring a bag of coffee, then you can have some coffee, but they have a lot left over. And you can bring them the Majority FM blend and you turn them on to the show. You see how this works? MajorityApp.com to get the app. It is the best way to listen to the show. It is a free app. You can listen live. You can stream podcasts. You can download them if you know you're going to be out of range. You can watch the show live on video, I believe, or you can watch clips at the very least. You can IM the show. You can call the show. You can share on Facebook and on Twitter. And it's all ad-free. If you're a member, you can log in and you can get access to the past 950 shows, I think we're at now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm exhausted just talking about how many shows we've done. All right, we're going to take a break. The number 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number if you want to be a part of this program. You can also IM me at Majority FM. We're going to do a random rush, maybe right when we get back. We'll be right back after this.